lifting the COVID curfew in Miami-Dade, the new top cop in Miami, and who could be the newest Florida congressperson? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. You can stay out and businesses can stay open past midnight beginning next week in Miami-Dade County. Restrictions on restaurants have been eased, and Broward County is moving to reduce COVID rules as more people get vaccinated. The city of Miami's new police chief is less than a week into the job, and he's looking to fire some officers under investigation.
I've now put internal affairs directly reporting to me as the chief of police. We want to fire people, but apparently the cases are there for upwards to a year and longer, and these people, these officers on the payroll.
It's all ahead coming up on the South Florida Roundup, made possible on WLRN by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week and for supporting public radio. Miami-Dade will be open for business past midnight beginning next week for the first time since July.
With the advent of the vaccine, with the awareness of precautions, we believe that we can safely change the curfew.
That's Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava on WLRN's Sundial program this week. Just after midnight, Monday morning, the curfew will be lifted, allowing restaurants and bars to stay open past midnight. And a list of other restrictions are being replaced, including allowing restaurants to open at full capacity if they can put tables at least 6 feet apart. It means the possibility of more business and more jobs for restaurant workers.
We need to get all the people that are working in these establishments vaccinated. So we're putting out special messaging. We're doing special vaccination drives. We need to make sure that the people who are most at risk, which are the people that work in these establishments, are themselves protected as well.
Broward County will ease some of its restrictions as more people get vaccinated and the COVID-19 infection rate drops. Masks remain mandatory in many circumstances in public, though. But it is not a return to business as usual for the restaurant industry, at least not yet. In February, there were 20% fewer people working in the hospitality industry than a year earlier in South Florida as the pandemic began to take hold. While thousands of jobs have been returning each month, finding restaurant and bar workers, owners tell us, isn't easy. Do you work in a restaurant? Did you work in a restaurant before the pandemic? Have you moved away from the industry as it is reopening? Have you visited your favorite restaurant or bar lately? You waiting to stay out past midnight on Monday morning? What will the easier rules mean for such an important source of jobs in the local economy? Join our conversation live on this Friday, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also hit us up on Twitter. We're at WLRN. Michael Beltran is with us now, chef and owner of Ariete Hospitality Group, the owner and operator of a number of restaurants in Dade County. Michael, thanks for your time. What are your plans for 12:01 a.m. Monday morning? Are you gonna have to do a last call before that, or are you going to stay open?
Well, first, thanks for having me on the show. This all kind of happened rather quickly, even though we planned that this was probably going to be the case. Internally, we thought that after the spring break craziness kind of calmed down, that we were going to see this curfew lifted. Mm-hmm. And we anticipated that that internally for our restaurants, nothing was going to change. We close at 11, our restaurants, but we do also operate two bars as well. And the bars will stay open later, but we won't change any of our other kind of guidelines for guests to enjoy our establishments. So, masks are still required, all the same guidelines that we had before that we never changed, even though, certain guidelines did change, we kept them all pretty much the same.
Right. So at Ariette Hospitality Group, it'll be a later last call, but you're mm-hmm. not necessarily increasing capacity in your dining rooms then.
Right. I mean, it's kind of unrealistic to ask restaurants and say that you could have 100% capacity if the tables are going to be 6 feet apart, because
right.
I don't know if politicians understand that per square foot price for real estate in Miami is very high.
Yeah.
So restaurants are usually pretty small on the indoors. So We're probably going to stay status quo the way things have been, you know, but something to note that was mentioned earlier was, you know, there's an opportunity or there's actually a good chance that we won't be able to open later every day of the week like we had previously because there is no staff to do so.
Yeah, so I was just going to ask you about what your staffing schedule looks like for mm-hmm. after midnight and if you're able to find the bartenders, bar backs, and others necessary to stay open for business.
We're not. Staffing is a huge issue right now. There are plenty of jobs to be had, and there really isn't many workers to have them. And, you know, just me personally, I know that we had 150 employees pre-pandemic, and, you know, a lot of those people change jobs. You know, they work in warehouses for Amazon, or they're on a delivery truck or something along those lines. And, you know, I get it. I don't blame them. And I think that as time goes on, you know, some of them, because, you know, kitchen, I think restaurants is a labor of love. People will miss it and they will come back, but it'll take some time.
Chef, stick with us. Michael Beltran, chef and owner of Ariette Hospitality Group. Carlos Frias is with us now, the Miami Herald food editor. Carlos, always great to have you on. Thanks for your time today.
No, thanks for having me. I'm always glad to participate.
Yeah, as you hear from the chef there, why are restaurants having a tough time finding workers?
I mean, what Mike is saying is happening throughout Miami-Dade, throughout South Florida, throughout the nation. There is an industry-wide shortage of people. Part of that may be just ramping up, you know, as more places are starting to open up, you know, there's a call for folks. But the reality is, like Mike said, is for restaurants have been limited in their capacity for so long that some of these folks who had limited ability to work, you know, limited hours and what have you, just decided to go in a different field. One of the things to remember is that nationally, the number is about 40% of staffs are part-time. So it's folks that are working in restaurants part-time, and those folks might have started looking for part-time employment in other sectors of hospitality and of different industries.
Yeah. What kind of financial shapes are restaurants in South Florida in after operating with a curfew, with the capacity limitations for so many months, Carlos?
I think you find a range. You know, there are places that have closed, but folks that have been able to kind of pivot quickly, and the fact that South Florida largely remained open when the rest of the country did not, yeah, meant that some places are actually doing pretty well. And you know, Mike can tell you certainly about what his particular situation is, but I have heard from restaurants that have said, you know, I'm kind of embarrassed to say that, you know, we're actually doing pretty well. And that's despite the fact that their hands are tied, you know, when it's come to staffing and such.
Yeah, Mike, I've heard from some restaurant owners and operators as well that as things have opened up, particularly as we've seen other parts of the country remain relatively closed and travel pick up a lot over the past couple of weeks, people coming to South Florida and going to restaurants, they've reported anecdotally, you know, business is 90-95% what it was previous to the pandemic. How about at your places, Mike?
I think, again, it's different for everybody. I think we're very fortunate. My two restaurants that are actually open because one is under construction are very fortunate that we have a ton of outdoor seating. So I think it differs for everybody. You know, like we're, even during the pandemic when everything was like at its peak bad and we could stay open, we still had a gigantic patio that I put 10 feet between every table, you know, because we were going to do whatever we could to kind of survive at that point. You know, we're doing okay. It's honestly hit or miss every other day. I mean, you never know, especially in today's world. Like, we don't know what season is going to be like here. Summer could be a gigantic drop off, or it could not. We're prepared for either scenario. But I know plenty of, you know, colleagues of mine that are not experiencing even, you know, hit or miss days. They're just missing all their days because they don't have that luxury of outdoor seating like a lot of other people may have.
Mike Beltran, chef and owner of Ariette Hospitality Group, is with us. Carlos Frias, the Miami Herald food editor, talking about the restaurant industry, lifting of the curfew in Miami-Dade County beginning early Monday morning, 12:01 a.m. Bars, restaurants, other businesses can remain open. Easing of some restrictions in Dade County. The expected easing in the days and weeks ahead of some restrictions in Broward County, and particularly the impact on hospitality and the restaurant industry, which is the source of so many jobs in South Florida. We want to hear from you if you've worked in a restaurant or bar, furloughed, laid off, job disappeared because of the pandemic. Have you waited around? Have you moved on with your professional career out of financial necessity? 800-743-9576. Call us live on this Friday, 800-743-9576. What do you make of the easing of restrictions as vaccines continue expanding?
My name is Matt Trask, and I live in Boca Raton, where I'm a graduate student at FAU's College of Education. I received my coronavirus vaccinations courtesy of the West Palm Beach VA medical system. I'm concerned about a general relaxing of safety rules in nearby counties. Each time we've seen political decisions to reopen, we've seen coronavirus spikes and sad consequences. We've managed to get this far together. Why is it so hard to wait just a little longer? I think that the CDC guidance on relaxing restrictions for those who are fully vaccinated shows us the way out of our current restrictions, and politically expedient haste only makes it last longer.
Are you planning on taking advantage of the lack of a curfew in Miami-Dade County? Have you visited your favorite restaurant? If you've worked in the restaurant industry, share that experience with us. 800-743-9576.
I'm Laura Askowitz, a resident of Boca Raton. I'm okay with things opening up. I think that post-vaccine, people need to make their own decisions on what they feel like doing. I've started to go out more, and I've just had my second shot, which absolutely did make me feel like I had the flu for a day. And for those that don't believe in the vaccine or are planning to not take it, I've given a lot of thought to that, and I do believe I have a responsibility to protect them by continuing to use a mask even after I have passed my two-week mark after the vaccine.
800-743-9576 to join our conversation here on the South Florida Roundup. Carlos Frias, Miami Herald food editor, Mike Beltran, chef and owner of Ariette Hospitality Group. Mike, how are you addressing some of the anxiety of not only diners, but perhaps, concerns from staff members and dealing with their worries about this pandemic and the virus, and now their ability, if they are interested, to get a vaccine?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I've pretty stayed strong on, and we have as a company, is like, it doesn't matter how much they relax the kind of guidelines, we're going to stick with what we've been doing the whole time, which is space between tables, which is open air as much as we can, outdoor seating as much as we can. Masks are always a necessity for both staff and for guests alike, sanitation stations, the whole thing. I mean, I don't feel like just because the government could be relaxing guidelines means that I'm going to relax the way that we've been operating, because I'd rather not go back to square one. And I think a lot of that is on the responsibility of the owner of different establishments to make sure that they kind of stand strong in those things. Yeah. Because as many people have mentioned, we don't want to go back to square one, and yeah, we are a big part of that,
Mike, let me ask you, if a worker comes to you and asks for paid time off to go get a vaccine, they may have to wait in line, or they don't feel so well after that second dose because of some side effects. How are you approaching that as a business owner?
They get paid time off. I mean, we've...
Even part-timers?
We don't really, because we're so understaffed, we don't have any part-timers, to be honest. We've had people that have said, someone and someone and someone was in contact, I'm going to need the next 3 days. And, you take the next 3 days. And if that means that me as an owner or my director of operations or whoever it may be on the director level needs to step in and do their job, then that's what we do.
Yeah. Carlos Frias, food editor with the Miami Herald. There's a lot of money available to restaurateurs in the latest stimulus plan, the American Rescue Plan Act. There's a grant program for restaurants. Some of the rules are still a little bit vague and application process not quite clear just yet. But is the industry excited for this locally? Are they talking about this?
I think right now the big Restaurants Rescue Act was you know, had planned to be able to inject that money, and folks are certainly looking forward to that. I mean, I can tell you personally about what that's going to mean for their ability to be flexible and to hire. But I think it all just comes down to having people. I mean, that's the one thing that we keep hearing over and over again is finding the number of people. And I think what you're going to see is 6 weeks from Monday. Okay. I think is when you're going to see a real inflection point, because a lot of folks were saying, this is the only industry where servers are working in direct contact with an unmasked public, generally.
Sure.
And those who were scared of going back because they didn't have early access to vaccine, well, now vaccines are open to everyone in Florida. So I think that we'll see by the time, you know, when folks are able to get vaccines, when they're fully vaccinated, are they going to finally say, okay, now I feel safer working in an environment where I'm around the public who, you know, may not be masked or who are not masked.
Yeah.
And I think I'm really curious to see what happens a month and a half from now.
We've got some callers here that we want to get to before we have to take a break. And Kendall, Carlos on line two. Carlos, thanks for calling. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Absolutely. Yes, I was driving down to Miami Beach. I was working at a very high-end hotel over in Surfside. And I got furloughed in March. And right when, the pandemic was blowing up, not everybody knew what was happening with it. But, I was in the industry for over 40 years, and I had to make a career change. You know, I lost my benefits. I worked at the hotel for 4 years, and there was really nothing out there. All the hotels were closed, servers, waiters, chefs, sous chefs, everybody, you know, you're working hands-on with the food, and you're dealing with all kinds of guests, front of the house and back of the house. So basically everything shut down. I'm from California, and moving over here was quite a shock for everybody. But the thing about it is that I had to make a career change. So believe it or not, I took like a $40,000 pay cut, and I became a baker at a grocery store. And, you learn to adjust, really learn to adjust. And a lot of the people that I worked with, they were just furloughed, and they went on unemployment, and then they found out that unemployment was actually paying, you know, decent amount of money. And a lot of them have held out. You know, some of them are still collecting unemployment, and some of them have made career changes.
Yeah.
Carlos,
did you say you took a $40,000 pay cut?
Yeah, $40,000 pay cut. Absolutely. Yep. I was one of the head chefs at a high-end hotel.
Yeah.
And, doing everything, managing people, saucier, butcher, doing the whole thing.
But you're working now as the baker. If that hotel manager came back to you now, what would you say? Or have they come back to you?
They have come back to me. Actually, I got a call from the general manager who called me up and sent me an urgent message. And then I spoke with the food and beverage manager. But now there are so many rules. There's so many rules. You have to go in and you have to have your temperature checked. Everybody is constantly under the eye.
Sure.
You have to wear a mask. And the thing about it is that I've been in it since the 70s. And to go back with a pandemic like this, it's never going to be the same. You're never going to have that really nice contact with your guests. Some of your guests might object for any reason, why aren't you wearing gloves, or why aren't you wearing a mask, or, sometimes you would have some of the guests going into the kitchen and just saying hello, and you know they see people not wearing the proper protection, and they might get bothered by that.
Yeah.
So everything's going to be this totally different.
Carlos, I really appreciate you sharing. You're happy as a baker.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah,
I love it.
Very good.
I'm even happier making less money, believe it or not. You learn to adjust.
Carlos and Kendall, thanks for sharing your story. We really appreciate it. Mariana and Key Biscayne, you're up next. Thanks for calling in. You're on the radio.
Hi, thank you for having me. So I am 22 and just graduated from undergrad back in 2020 spring. And that was right when the pandemic hit. Didn't get a graduation and graduated in hospitality and tourism management. So all of the opportunities I had lined up, I was finishing up some interviews, just fell through immediately. Everybody was hit really hard by the pandemic and didn't even really have the time to think about newcomers, let alone how they were going to function. So very discouraging for a little bit, but fortunately I was able to move back home and decided to actually go back to school and get a master's in entrepreneurship and hospitality. So that way when a year would pass by, I'd be able to have a little bit of a advantage on my resume, and hopefully things would be opening up by after another year. And looks like things are opening up. And what I've heard so far is that a lot of hospitality businesses are looking for fresh new people who are who are at entry level, who have some experience.
Mario, you'll be graduating this spring with that master's?
In August.
In August. Well, congratulations. Let me put that opportunity to Mike Beltran. There's a young voice, a young professional wanting to start out in hospitality in this industry amid a pandemic. What kind of career advice, Mike, would you have for Marianne in Key Biscayne?
Oh, man, so much advice. I have so many things I would like to tell you. But I think, the true thing is to find a style of restaurant and a style of concept and a style of food, for that matter, that you really want to learn about. If you want to specialize in hotels, and that's something you should double down on. If you want to specialize in independent restaurants, you need to double down there, and you really need to get that experience. And experience, to me, in this industry, speaks volumes. Yeah.
Mike, I just want to point out we heard from Carlos earlier from Kendall, who had been in the industry for 40 plus years and left for a lower paying job. Mariana, on the early part of beginning her career at this moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's really not that rare to me. 40 years is a long time.
It's a long haul.
I feel for it. Yeah, I feel for him the way things happened, for sure, because he's not an isolated case. There's so many like that. But, I went from being an executive sous chef somewhere to then taking 10 steps backwards to work for great people for a decade. And then that decade led me into my restaurants that I own now.
Mike, I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm just short on time. Carlos Frias with the Miami Herald. I want to give you an opportunity to play mentor there to Mariana. You get so many great sources in the industry. What kind of environment is she stepping into in hospitality as she begins her career?
I think, especially if she's vaccinated or she gets to that point, I think she's stepping in at probably one of the best times, because everybody is hiring. People are trying to outbid each other for staff. For the first time, you are seeing folks offering higher starting wages, benefits, including health insurance, something that has not been terribly common in the restaurant industry as a whole. I mean, you're even seeing franchises saying that they're offering, paternal and maternal time off, leave time. These are things that the industry has been pushing for a long time. So I would say, like, she's entering at a time where the industry is being forced to change because of competing for top talent. So I think she might be, at the cutting edge, at the bleeding edge of being in the right place at the right time.
Carlos Frias, Miami Herald food editor. Carlos, always great to have you on the program. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Mike Beltran, chef and owner of Ariette Hospitality Group. Chef, thanks for stepping out of the kitchen for us this afternoon. Much appreciated.
Thanks for having me.
We got lots more to come here on the South Florida Roundup. Next, the new police chief in the city of Miami. Our interview with Chief Art Acevedo is next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. The city of Miami got a new police chief this week. Art Acevedo was sworn into office. He was the police chief in Houston, Texas, and he's known for his outspoken style. He was born in Cuba, came to the United States when he was 4 years old. He marched with protesters after the death of George Floyd last spring, and he takes over a police department that had been under federal oversight after almost three dozen police shootings, including seven shootings of black men. We spoke with Acevedo Thursday. Chief, welcome to WLRN. Congratulations on the job and welcome to Miami. This week at your swearing-in ceremony, you said, quote, we're going to be the Miami Love Boat. Child of the 1980s, I got that reference to that television show. But what did you mean by that?
I meant that we are, you know, operating at a time, and I think as police officers in our nation's history, where mistrust of government is a fever pitch high, where the division in this country, we're such a divided nation, is at a historical high as well. That the police department, we need to love everybody we come in contact with. We need to be the police chief and the police officers and the public servants for everyone, and we need to be a unifying force and a force that brings peace to our community. And so we're going to move ahead, forge ahead, build bridges of trust, respect, and hopefully cooperation, which will lead to greater safety for all Miamians.
I know you're only a few days into the position, but how would you describe those bridges of trust that you're inheriting?
I wear my uniform every day, and the reason I do that is because it gives me an opportunity to gauge people's reactions to the uniform. You know, it is our brand. It identifies us as to who we are. So far, the response has been overwhelmingly positive, but I also know that there are relationships, our work, and there's still work to do in terms of making it stronger and better, our relationship with the communities, especially with communities of color and with poor communities, to include poor white communities, disproportionately over throughout history have been impacted the most when bad policing happens. It happens in those communities. And so, you know, we're going to always be judged, not just through the prism of the present, the prism of our own actions today, but also through the prism of history. And we need to understand that, because the history of policing is somewhat ugly. And there's still ugly incidents going on. And so we have to recognize that and work doubly hard to overcome that.
Another piece that you've inherited is the Department of Justice supervision that just ended prior to you coming in. It ended in February of this year, but it was in place since 2016. And the Federal Department of Justice determined that the Miami Police Department engaged in a pattern of excessive use of deadly force. As you have come into this position of leadership after the Department of Justice has ended its supervision, what sticks around? What's changed? What's sustainable after this supervision?
Well, I think what sticks around is the aftermath, the knowledge of the consequences of not engaging in constitutionally lawful conduct, and the burden and the challenge that comes with being in the consent decree. I think there's a greater appreciation by the men and women of this police department for conducting ourselves in a manner that's consistent with the requirements of the Constitution. And I think that as a result of the recommendations of the Department of Justice and the oversight of the monitor, the department's put into place systems, processes, training, policy, and oversight that will help us stay on track. Having said that, you know that if you're not careful, you can take, you know, 5 step forwards and 10 step backwards. We have to understand that organizational excellence and development and moving forward is never ends. Those efforts never end. And we have to continue to keep our eye on the ball, ensuring that we're robust in our oversight of our own men and women, and ensuring that we continue to look for opportunities to do better.
Does there need to be more oversight of active duty police officers?
One of the things that this will may create some issues in the community. One of the things that I've noticed that I've inherited is that when we have an officer involved shooting, the department has given its investigations to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, FDLE. I have a little bit of heartburn with that, because that has not been my experience. Because when you do that, I'm hearing of cases where it's taken a year and a half, you know. That's a problem. You know, justice delayed is justice denied.
What agency should investigate those shootings?
Well, I'll tell you what. If I had the opportunity to investigate it, I would, and they can conduct a parallel investigation. But I guarantee you that we're not going to be taking a year to investigate an officer-involved shooting if my people and the team that I would put together would do it.
Isn't the idea of having the FDLE step in, though, as having an independent agency investigate a police department as opposed to the agency investigating its own department?
Yeah, I think that is the idea. But if there's going to be a parallel investigation and additional investigation, I'm good with that. But if they're going to do that investigation, it's important that it be timely. What I'm being told by a lot of folks, and I'm just starting to look into this, so I don't know if it's true or not, that the investigations and the state attorney's office and everyone's taken forever. I've now put internal affairs as of yesterday's directly reporting to me as the chief of police. And we have cases that are languishing there that we want to fire people, but apparently the cases are there for upwards to a year and longer. And these people, these officers on the payroll.
How many officers do you think are tagged to be terminated?
I would say that, if my memory serves me right, we've got probably upwards of 10 that we're looking at. And the first thing I'm going to do is get together with the state attorney here in the next week or so, and the director of the FDLE, because I don't believe that we should be waiting and taking that long to take action. And so it's a balance, and I'm fine with someone else taking over and conducting an independent investigation, but it has to be timely. If it's not going to be timely, I'm going to act in those instances where I believe people need to be fired.
Chief, this estimated 10 officers that you think are on the path toward termination, what are the accusations?
They ran the gamut from, more often than not, the majority of them are about really uses of force that are not objectively reasonable. Officers that exceeded the authority granted to them by the law that requires us to use force that is objectively reasonable. From what the briefing I received yesterday, I've got cases that it appears to me, based on my judgment, experience, and training and understanding of the law and the Constitution, that these folks acted outside of the requirements, acted excessively. And we should not have to wait for a year or a year and a half to get the resolution. That really hurts the standing of law enforcement, and that really hurts morale in the department, especially when officers know that they may have a bad apple amongst them, and the rest of the officers that are doing the job right are getting the same exact pay as a person is getting paid to do nothing.
Are one of the first actions, big actions, you're going to be taking as chief, firing officers?
Well, that's we don't fire officers, they fire themselves. When I got my briefing with internal affairs this week with the major, I looked at and got briefed on these cases where it clearly these handful of officers have no business wearing the uniform they're wearing. And so some of them have been languishing for months and upwards to a year, and that's just not acceptable.
Have you opened up conversations with the Fraternal Order of Police, the union, regarding these officers?
But that's not the union's, you know, doing. This is our doing. This is government's doing. This is, you know, our partners doing. And so I have not had that conversation with them. We're slated to meet. We've already met once. But it is just not appropriate for these cases to languish so long. We're not going to be a department like in the past where they allowed cases to reach the statute of limitations and nothing, little to nothing can be done to officers engaged in malfeasance.
We're speaking with the new City of Miami Police Chief Art Acevedo. Chief Acevedo, you come in to this position with a big national focus on policing, particularly because of the trial that is ongoing in Minneapolis against former police officer Derek Chauvin on trial for murder in the killing of George Floyd. Floyd's killing sparked protests last May across the country, across the world, and here in South Florida, also in Houston, where you were police chief. How is the Miami Police Department preparing for the trial's eventual verdict?
Well, we actually met. It's funny, everything you're asking about, we're dealing with. So we met yesterday. I met with my team, and as president of the Major City Chiefs, which is 69 largest agencies in the country and is 9 largest in Canada, we actually have been talking about crowd management and you know, lessons learned, the good, the bad, and the ugly of what happened last summer, because as a profession, we want to make sure that we're as good to perfect as we can as it relates to dealing with these dynamic and sometimes most of the times emotional, but sometimes dangerous situations.
And so what about rules of engagement? We know that Miami police used tear gas and rubber bullets in May when protesters were throwing rocks and bottles, for instance. There were broken windows. Protesters caused property damage in downtown Miami. What are the rules of engagement that you're putting in place for the force for this eventual verdict?
Well, let me just be real clear. You know, I always say don't confuse kindness for weakness. We will allow people to exercise their First Amendment rights, which means they can march, they can They can protest. They can lift up their voices. They can scream. They can be angry. But there's a clear line between First Amendment protected activity and criminal activity. We're not going to allow people to hurt others, hurt our officers, or damage property. When they, when you cross the line, that's called criminal activity, and we will use whatever reasonable means and authorized means. The one thing I can tell you, and I already told my team, I don't believe in widespread use of tear gas. You know, there's a difference between the pepper spray balls that you can target a person that's actually engaging in violence or engaging in destruction of property. We're not going to be gassing the heck out of entire crowds where you're not just getting the person that's being violent, but also peaceful protesters. We're going to be strategic. We're going to be surgical, and we're going to be a department that will isolate those that are engaging in criminal activity, remove them, arrest them, have them prosecuted, and then let those that are engaging in a peaceful protest, lawful protest, continue to exercise their rights.
Chief, let me ask you about one strategy that protesters and demonstrators have used. They used last year, which was marching on to interstate highways. We saw this on I-95 through downtown Miami. We saw it around the MacArthur Causeway, for instance, where demonstrators and protesters essentially shut down these roadways. How do you engage with that? How do you think of that activity? Is that lawful?
No, first of all, forget the lawfulness. That is absolutely reckless and dangerous. I remember that in Houston, we had a very, because I lead from the front, a very, very tense standoff because we stopped the march because they were heading towards a freeway. And I explained to them after about 15, 20 minutes of shouting and losing my voice that I'm responsible for their safety. And if they go on the freeway, which is what someone wanted to do, I can't ensure their safety. And in a world of mental illness, in a world of, you know, hate groups, in a world of white supremacist groups that may not like these protesters, I cannot stop an 18-wheeler from running them over. A little explanation went a long way. We were able to get enough resources to keep them marching without getting on the freeway. Everybody went on their way. Everybody was happy. But a week later, I remember this, in Minneapolis, we had an individual on an 18-wheeler mowed down a bunch of folks on the freeway. So we're not going to let people on the freeway. We'll do everything we can to stop them. And if they get on the freeway, we'll do everything that we can get them off as soon as possible before some nut runs people over.
In Florida, there's legislation that is pending in the state legislature that would essentially allow a driver, if fleeing a demonstration or protesters, if they're concerned for their safety, their life, and they happen to hit and fatally injure a protester demonstrator, that would be considered covered under kind of a stand your ground type of theory. What are your thoughts?
Look, I think that's political theater. I think people know when they are in danger of losing their lives, they can do whatever it takes to get out of there. That's just a politician doing what they like to do, which is engaging in theater to appease people. The bottom line is that's a silly season. It happens all over the country. And what we need to think about is making sure that police officers have good strategies to keep people off the freeway and that people have situational awareness when they know that there's going to be protests to avoid the area. And that at the end of the day, we're all human beings and we need to be respectful of one another.
Chief, you may feel that way, but as you call it, the silly season, that could become law in Florida.
Yep. Well, we know that stand your ground laws have created problems, not just in Florida, but across the country. Common sense goes a long way. If people are starting to break into your vehicle and trying to do what happened to Reginald Denny during the L.A. riots, where I happened to be a young acting sergeant with the California Highway Patrol.
That was in the early 1990s. He was the truck driver who was dragged after the Rodney King verdict when the police officers were found not guilty in beating Mr. King.
Exactly. You know, that's a situation where somebody may be justified in accelerating and getting out of there. But again, common sense is what should be driving us. And I think that, again, this is more about theater than it is about utilizing good sense, which is what we should be focusing on in terms of legislation.
He is the new chief of police in the city of Miami, Art Acevedo. Chief Acevedo, thanks for your time.
Thank you. I look forward to working with you in the upcoming years.
Still to come on the program, filling the empty seat in Congress from South Florida after the death of Congressman Alcee Hastings. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Alcee Hastings died this week. He was the most veteran member of Florida's delegation to the United States House of Representatives. He was first elected to Congress from Florida in 1993. His death leaves an empty seat in the House for a district that includes parts of Broward and Palm Beach counties and is overwhelmingly Democratic. What's the impact for voters in South Florida who don't have a representative right now in the House? If you live in the 20th Congressional District, what do you think about an election to fill that empty seat? Live on this Friday, join us, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Christine Stapleton is the political reporter at the Palm Beach Post and joins us now. Christine, what's the process for filling this vacant seat in Congress?
Well, it's interesting. It is under U.S. Code Section 8, Title 2, and it says that the governor of the state has 49 days in which to hold the election. There was some concern about whether it was 49 days to set the election, but the code is pretty clear that it's 49 days to have the election, so we should be having an election in the next 49 days. The interesting thing is, though, what do we do about when we have a situation with many candidates from a particular party? Will there be a primary? Will the party simply nominate a candidate? Because we have a situation now where we already have three Democratic candidates that are running. So we don't know if all three of them will appear on the on a ballot, if the party will nominate one of them, or if maybe there'll be time for a primary.
And so it would be the election would be what, around before Memorial Day or so?
Yes, roughly? That's what the code, that's what it says for these congressional seats. A little different for House, state seats, but federal seats, yes.
And is there any stipulation about, you know, 50% plus one vote for a winner, or it's just a plurality?
Well, that goes into it, too, because if the Democratic Party decides to have all of their candidates on the ballot, it is going to dilute the vote. And a Republican candidate, and there is one, would have a better chance at that point. So it is we have some interesting times ahead.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah. We'll talk more about kind of who the candidates are potentially positioning, who they are, who we know they are, and who we think they may be coming up. Alex Dougherty joins us now, too. He covers Washington, D.C. for McClatchy and the Miami Herald. Always great to have you on as well. What does this vacancy mean for the Democratic majority on Capitol Hill, Alex?
So as of next week, when we expect a new Republican representative to be sworn into Congress when they come back, Nancy Pelosi can only afford to lose two Democratic votes on any piece of legislation and have it still pass the House of Representatives. Democrats will have a 6-vote margin in the House. They can't lose three. Tie votes are not like baseball. You lose if that happens. So there's not a lot of wiggle room. And we are now in the midst of Joe Biden wanting to pass a major piece of infrastructure legislation. If the COVID relief bill that became law earlier this year is any indication, he's not likely to get much, if any, Republican support in Congress. So this really complicates the math for, in particular, Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Does the Speaker slow the roll on the Biden agenda? In other words, waiting for that special election for Florida's 20th congressional district, anticipating a Democratic succession to now the deceased Congressman Hastings?
So there are a few other open Democratic seats. Three House members now have positions in the Biden administration. Those three seats are currently open. All three seats are in heavily Democratic districts and will likely be filled with a Democrat. So those three seats are more likely to be filled before Hastings is. In two of those cases, they've already moved forward with the primary process. So we should see them get filled at least in the next couple of months. Rather, in Hastings' case, I think you're likely to see this seat unfilled throughout the entire summer, if history is any indication. So yes, it's important, but there are some other seats out there. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland's congressional seat in New Mexico, for example, that will get filled before Hastings.
Christine, all right, the calculus here. Who's expressed interest in this congressional seat?
Well, we have three Democrats that have already thrown their hat in, and two of them are Broward County Commissioners, Dale Holness and Commissioner Sharif. Mm-hmm. And then we also have a woman who challenged Congressman Hastings before. Her name is Sheila Turfelis McCormick. And we have both of those have raised some money. the two women that are running. Commissioner Sharik has raised about $113,000. She's loaned herself about $100,000. And then Ms. Sharik has also raised about $70,000. Mm-hmm. We have Matt Boswell, who is another Democrat running. And we have one Republican running, and he's run against the former Representative Hastings. And his name is Greg Musselwhite. So he has also thrown his hat in it. And there may be some others that come forward. What's interesting, though, about the candidates that we have now is that all of them are African-American on the Democratic side. Mm-hmm. Mr. Musselwhite is white. And this is a very diverse district, too. So, we see two African-American women that are running. And then Mr. Boswell is also an African-American.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the district and the constituents. This is a district that is not Oceanside, but it stretches across Broward and parts of Palm Beach County, has some kind of high density areas, neighborhoods and some rural areas in it.
Yes, it's a very unique district in that you're right. It does have both urban areas and agricultural rural areas. The population is about 800,000 and 53% is Black. Only 38% of the population is white. And of the registered voters in the county as of November, the election, it was 63% were Democrats and only 12% were GOP. But yeah, we do have a large number of independent voters in the district also.
Alex, let me ask you, national Republicans, this has long been a Democratic seat, but are national Republicans looking at this special election as a potential opportunity?
The short answer is no. The Democratic Party has a stranglehold over this seat the way that it's drawn. This seat will elect a Democrat if numbers are any concern. The bigger concern is how a dispersed primary, which we have, a few candidates officially in the race, a few more this week have said they plan to run. And I think we are going to see even more jump in the next couple of weeks. The real question is going to be how, a 5-, 6-, or even 7-way primary flushes out, because someone could end up with a seat in Congress, just like Congressman Hastings did for, a very long time with on the back of, maybe as little as 5,000 or 7,000 votes.
And Christine, as you mentioned, a number of the declared candidates, at least two of them, are current county commissioners. Florida has the resign to run law. And so this could have implications in the Broward County Commissioner, Broward County Commission.
Yes, the trickle-down effect is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Commissioner Holmes has not filed the paperwork. I don't believe he's filed the paperwork
yet. Fair enough.
Yet.
Thank you for that correction.
He will. Yeah. Yes, yes. Correct. And but those seats would have to, they would have to resign in order to run, which would leave two seats open for the governor to make an appointment, which he would likely, appoint Republicans. So that would really change the demographic of the commission, which is now, Democratic. So we have that. And then also Mac Bernard, District 84 in Palm Beach County, mm-hmm. there's been talk that he might throw his hat in. And that's interesting because his seat would be vacant and there would have to be a special election to fill his seat that yeah. would not be appointed by the governor. So the trickle-down effect of this is just, it's really interesting.
It's fascinating. Christine, any insight on when the election schedule will be announced?
No, and I would expect, as Alex had mentioned, the governor will probably take his time on this.
Yeah.
There's no incentive to actually hold it quickly.
Christine Stapleton, the political reporter at the Palm Beach Post. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us, Christine. Great to have you on.
Thanks.
Alex Doherty covers Washington, D.C. for McClatchy and the Miami Herald. Alex, always a pleasure to have you on our program as well. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks.
Finally, on the roundup this week, Odes to Your Zip Codes. Zip Odes is back. We've partnered again with the O Miami Poetry Festival to invite you to write an ode to your zip code. Now, you don't think you're a poet? Well, as long as you have a zip code, you can write an ode to it. Here's how. You use the 5-digit zip code to write a 5-line poem. Each digit of your zip code determines how many words per line. It works like this.
Hi, my name is Catherine Shahada, and I live in Coral Gables. My zip code is 33134. Everyone here seems weathered from the storm of last century. Everyone is a lifer.
Or this one we received from Christopher Nataracola, 33062. He writes, our lighthouse keeps boats from sinking, What will boats do when our lighthouse sinks? We also got this one this week from Ellie Groden at 33133. Why did the peacock cross the road? Because we live in Coconut Grove. You can write your own Zipode using our handy online tool. You'll find it at wlrn.org/zipodes. wlrn.org/zipodes. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's director of radio programming is Jason Sabka. The director of radio operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting public radio. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.